Trump snubs the foreign press today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump often keeps international media out of his events, even that big foreign policy speech he gave recently.
Foreign press were denied from entering that, and you would think that a foreign policy speech, you'd want foreign media there to hear about it, to write about it.
Also, voters in the Philippines wanted a new kind of president. Now they have one.
Somebody like Duterte comes off as your uncle who's standing drunkenly in the street corner making jokes.
Plus, Quebec poutine wows them in Las Vegas. We're talking fries, swimming in cheese curd, gravy, and more healthy stuff.
Well, this one is just like the best bacon cheeseburger that you ever had, just kind of exploded, and now you're just going to eat the remains of it.
Those stories today on The World. Glad you could be with us today. I begin the show with this question. What if they held an election and no one covered it? Okay, that's not going to happen. Not nationally in the U.S. anyway. But a lot of foreign media outlets are being shut out of the coverage of this current presidential race, specifically from Donald Trump's events. Hadass Gold co-wrote a story about this for Politico, and Gold says there's a lot of international interest in Trump.
I think that the foreign press is especially interested just because of the type of candidate that he is and the things that he's saying about foreign governments. He's talking about, you know, pulling out of NATO. He's talking about all these different issues that would directly affect other countries. So we've seen an immense amount of foreign press interest in his candidacy, and yet they can't get in. They can't get interviews. They can't get responses to basic questions they send, and they can't even attend press conferences or rallies.
So tell us what is going on, Hadass, in terms of foreign media getting access to Trump events. Is there a pattern?
There's definitely a pattern, just that if you are from a foreign media outlet that doesn't have necessarily like a huge presence in the United States, for example, the BBC or The Guardian, their journalists don't have this problem because they have big American audiences. But let's say you're a Japanese TV station or the Chinese news wires, they have not been able to get access to most of the rallies, most of the press conferences. They haven't been able to get Donald Trump to sit down for interviews with them. They can't even get basic responses to their questions that they send to Donald Trump's press office.
But high school newspapers in some of these localities are getting access.
Exactly. And that's what's so stunning is, you know, you've got these major news organizations, for example, ARD from Germany, one of the largest broadcasters, hasn't been able to get in. And not even just to basic rallies, let's say, you know, some we talk to Republican communications specialists who have worked, let's say, on the Mitt Romney's campaign. His communications director said, yeah, sometimes we deny entry to a foreign media, but usually it was because we were very much constrained in space. We were in a tiny coffee shop. We couldn't fit everybody in, so we'd pool it. What was surprising for us was even that big foreign policy speech Donald Trump gave a couple weeks ago in Washington, D.C., foreign press were denied from entering that. And you would think that a foreign policy speech, you'd want foreign media there to hear about it, to write about it.
How does the Trump campaign justify this?
Well, initially, the Trump campaign was telling foreign media, we appreciate your interest, but we are focusing on local and national outlets. You know, from their point of view, and to be clear, they did not comment for our article. We asked them multiple times to comment on this, and they did not respond. But from their point of view, you know, foreign press does not represent voters. These are not the people who are going to elect Donald Trump to be president, so they care less about it. And, you know, this really fits in with Donald Trump's whole mantra about his campaign, make America great again, America first. You know, he's showing preference to the American, to the local outlets, even if it's a high school outlet versus some foreign press outlet.
I mean, we're talking about Donald Trump and his campaign, but how unusual is this really? Don't candidates and elected officials all put up barriers to the media?
They do. And I mean, we've experienced this from candidates across the board, from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. There's always complaints from the media about access. But we rarely have seen just kind of this blanket policy of just absolutely no foreign press allowed into events.
Are you getting a sense from the correspondents who have been barred that this is just not good for America's reputation?
Definitely. They're so frustrated by this. They say they've never experienced anything like this before, at least in the United States. Just not what they're used to.
Hadass Gold of Politico, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
The Filipino many compare to Donald Trump is now president-elect of his country. Rodrigo Duterte is known as the tough-talking, tough-acting mayor of one of the largest cities in the Philippines, Davao. And after yesterday's landslide victory, Duterte is set to be sworn into office on June 30th. Reporter Aurora Almendral is in the capital, Manila, and joins me now. Some pundits say Duterte's election is just another victory for populist politics, simple solutions to complex problems, and voters evidently like that. Would you agree with that, Aurora?
Yeah, on some level, that's exactly what he did. He ran on almost single platform of peace and order. A lot of the people that voted for him said that this is the reason why they were voting, because they wanted less crime in the Philippines, drug dealers put to justice, and to have peace and order in the country.
How big was the landslide?
Pretty big. He was 15 points ahead of the next candidate, but he did only get 38% of the votes. So it was a landslide victory in terms of the following candidates, but he didn't get more than 50% of the Filipino vote.
So what is the mood now in the Philippines, now that they know there's this provocative man who's going to be leading the country for the next few years?
The mood is surprisingly unifying, considering how vitriolic, how vicious the days preceding the elections were. The current president accused Duterte of being a dictator in the making. Duterte was calling opponents bad words. Things were very bad in the lead up to the elections, but as soon as Duterte's lead became clear that he would become the president, the other candidates, they offer their support to Duterte, and it seems that people seem to be rallying behind Duterte, especially his opponents, who quickly unified behind him.
Today, the Sydney Morning Herald headline reads, "Forget Donald Trump, Australia needs to worry about the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte." And the point was the South China Sea, very hot and sensitive geopolitical space, and there's a lot of concern in Australia that somebody like Duterte could do something unpredictable and destabilize the whole region. What do you make of that?
Well, Duterte has particularly been pushing the buttons of Australia. Shortly before the elections, he made a really unsavory joke that outraged everyone about wanting to be the first to rape an Australian missionary that had died during a prison riot.
Yeah,
provocative statement. Very provocative statement. And after that, he threatened to cut ties with Australia. So it does make him seem like an unstable and unpredictable geopolitical player. As far as the South China Sea goes, earlier today mentioned that if China backed off from claiming the islands, he would do it as well. It seems that he's much more willing to take a more passive stance. But again, there's still a lot more talk than there are policy details.
Yeah, it sounds right now like his policy on the South China Sea is basically, China, you can squat, but don't say it's yours.
Yeah, basically. But the worrying thing about him is he is unpredictable, and he will say things seemingly off the cuff that sounds like it might have larger geopolitical consequences.
Do you get a sense that there is an overall distaste for conventional politicians in the Philippines right now? And is that part of what got Duterte this landslide victory?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of it, if not entirely, because every other politician has been a traditional politician. Dynasties are huge in the Philippines. And the next candidate that got the second most votes to Duterte, Mar Rojas, is the grandson of the first president of the republic. And so these kinds of oligarchical dynastic families have always looked after their own interests. And a lot of Filipinos are very tired of that, which is why somebody like Duterte comes off as your uncle who's standing drunkenly in the street corner making jokes. That's why he appeals a lot to Filipinos, because he seems like somebody who's like the average Filipino, and they think will connect with the problems of the average Filipino and the issues that are important to them.
Aurora Almendral, reporting from Manila in the Philippines. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
We're going to take a sharp turn now and talk about one of Canada's greatest inventions, not insulin or the light bulb. And yes, Canadians are credited with those. I'm talking about poutine, French fries doused in cheese curd and brown gravy. Poutine is Quebec's signature dish, great for those frigid winters, but now it's showing up fancified on menus from New York to L.A. It's in Las Vegas, though, where you'll find a poutine craze at the moment. The World's Jason Margolis has a story.
I heard about the Vegas poutine trend in a short article in the Las Vegas Weekly. So I emailed the writer, Brock Radke, and asked if he'd take me on a personal poutine tour. We began at Bruxy, a California-based chain.
So this poutine has waffle-cut French fries, which adds a new dimension of probably unnecessary gluttony, right? Chopped up bits of fried chicken, cheese curds, sausage gravy.
Methodically, we plow our way through the plate. We're both a little conflicted, though.
It's a little strange. Not bad.
Do you think they put on too many things?
No, I just think that these things don't seem to have anything to do with each other.
We decided to step back and try a more authentic poutine. We hit Smoke's Poutinerie, a Canadian chain recently opened in downtown Vegas.
So, you know, it comes from Canada, you gotta go to the source, right?
Hey guys, how you doing?
Robert Buckle, the friendly owner, greets us at the counter. He's not Canadian, he's a native Californian. Still, he gives us a basic poutine lesson. He says many Americans are a little afraid of poutine.
I do have to explain it to him. Like, just imagine it's mashed potatoes with gravy, but deep fried. Like, a lot of times it clicks in their mind, like, oh, that sounds really good.
These are all really, really good.
We sampled four varieties. Vegetarian, double pork, smoked meat with mushroom, and Radke's personal favorite, the bacon cheeseburger poutine.
Well, this one is just, like, the best bacon cheeseburger that you ever had just kind of exploded. And, you put a firecracker in it and nuked it, and now you're just going to eat the remains of it.
Yeah, what he just said. One problem, we were both beyond stuffed. Radke had to go lie down. My time in Vegas was limited, though, so I pressed on. Next stop, the Barrymore, a cool, classy Vegas steakhouse.
So, my name is Luis. I'm going to take care of you tonight. For my entrees, we have a bone-in ribeye, which is phenomenal.
I told the waiter, Luis Ponce, I was here for one thing and one thing only.
The poutine. Okay, this one is another, like, a really, really good side dish. So basically, we have fresh hand-cut fries, the fresh lamb crab meat over the top, a little bit of asparagus, and finish it with béarnaise over the top. Every single bite, you get a little bit of the crab, a little bit of the
asparagus. It was the most extraordinary plate of French fries I'd ever had. But I'm eating and thinking, there's no gravy here, no cheese curds. Does this even qualify as poutine? A lot of Canadians might say no, but they're not so worried about that in Vegas.
As far as how important it is to stay with a traditional poutine, I don't think it's so important anymore.
Kirk Perry is the general manager at the Barrymore and a longtime chef. He says with food in 2016, anything is game.
Between the ability to get ingredients from anywhere on the planet to the new modern techniques, I think that in today's blending world of cultures, cuisine is a great way for us to expand upon that and do new and creative things.
Well, three poutine stops in one day was more than enough for me. And where else can you really go after crab and asparagus on your fries? But this being Vegas, I was feeling greedy. I took a few days off, then went to the Public House, a restaurant at the high-end Venetian Hotel. The poutine here comes topped with duck confit, marinated for 24 hours, cheese curds, stout gravy, and one egg sunny side up. And chives. The sommelier, Bernard Urpicum, comes by to suggest a drink pairing.
You know, you want a light Pinot Noir, something more feminine. So you have the pink cherry, black cherries, so that it can substantiate the cheese curd, the French fries, without overpowering it.
I felt like I'd died and gone to poutine heaven.
Create a really interesting little dance between...
For the world, Jason Margolis, Las Vegas.
And all of those great flavors and...
Fries, melted cheese curd and gravy. Poutine is not known for how good it looks. It's all about how good it tastes. Still, we have some delicious-looking photos up at PRI.org. Prepare to get hungry.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs for answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from finance's role in addressing climate change to the implications of central bank policy decisions. Tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. If you watch House of Cards, you might want to try the real-life version following the news out of Brazil. Impeachment continues to stalk President Dilma Rousseff. She's accused of using funds from public banks to cover up gaps in the government budget. Rousseff denies she did anything wrong, but impeachment proceedings are already in motion. The World's Will Carlos is in Rio.
Well, the latest is that the next stage of this is a vote in the Senate, in Brazil's Senate, which happens tomorrow afternoon. And probably by tomorrow night, we may very well have a new leader of the largest country in South America.
may well have a new leader. So you're saying there will be an impeachment likely?
Well, so what happens is that the Senate is voting on whether to sort of launch an official actual investigation into her. But I mean, the net effect of that is that she will have to step down as president for 180 days if they vote that way. And it's widely expected that they're going to. They only have to get 50% of the vote, and most people think that they're going to get that. She will then have to step down, and her vice president, Michelle Temer, takes over for the time being.
What is the danger of all of this political chaos to the public? I mean, how are they losing out?
It's a weird one, because I think almost the chaos is sort of in the process. I mean, once we get to this sort of final stage of impeachment, and tomorrow is sort of the big final stage, then, you know, we have a new leader, things kind of calm down in theory, at least for the next sort of 180 days, and we can kind of move forward. So I think what's been so chaotic is in the lead up, nobody quite knows whether this is actually going to happen, whether we're going to have the impeachment or not. There's all of these sort of different recourses and different appeals and processes where they're trying to stop the impeachment from happening. Once she gets voted through the Senate, I think things calm down a little bit. And I think that in turn sort of calms investors down. It calms everybody who's watching Brazil down, and sort of people think, right, well, we're actually back to a little bit of stability for a few months now.
This impeachment story really has soap opera qualities to it. And I know Brazilians love their telenovelas. Have they kind of ditched the telenovelas in favor of this real life drama?
There's actually there's one in the works. I believe that there is a Netflix show in the works on Brazil's political chaos. So this is a case of sort of real life imitating art, and then art imitating real life again. You know, it's kind of a crazy situation. In the last 24 hours, we're absolutely manic in Brazil, as the new leader of the House suddenly decided that he was able to actually annul the vote of Congress last month that pushed forwards impeachment. He then came out at about midnight and said, no, actually, I was wrong. I can't do that. I'm retracting that. So there's more drama than any soap opera. It's an overused cliche, but people keep comparing Brazil to House of Cards with all the twists and turns going on.
The World's Will Carlos in Rio. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
In American politics this year, we've heard the phrase democratic socialist to describe Bernie Sanders. The word socialist just doesn't seem as taboo as it once was here. But what about communist? You may think the American Communist Party died along with the Soviet Union, but it's still here. Alina Simone recently went to visit party headquarters in New York City.
I admit it. I was hoping for plaster busts of Lenin, hammer and sickle flags, some good old-fashioned Soviet kitsch. But the headquarters of the Communist Party USA is more like a hipster loft, clean and modern, with a conference room housed inside a freestanding glass cube. It took me 10 minutes of hunting to find the collected works of Lenin on a dusty shelf. And there were more surprises. The 8-story party headquarters in Chelsea? The communists own the building, and it's worth millions. That's how they fund their work, by running out office space in one of New York's hottest zip codes.
The party's done very well. You know, we have an investment fund. We're very good at that.
How did you get good at that? You're the Communist Party.
Because we understand capitalism.
Jarvis Tyner has been a member of the party for 55 years and a leader in the movement for most of them. He ran for vice president twice in the 1970s on the Communist Party USA ticket and spent time in all the Cold War hotspots, the Soviet Union, Cuba, Vietnam. But it wasn't geopolitics that first drew Tyner to communism. It was more about Dick Clark.
You turn on Bandstand, they were all white kids. And they were dancing to often black artists. So we decided to challenge it.
After graduating from high school and struggling to find a job, Tyner fell in with a group of community activists. One of their campaigns was to integrate the dance floor of American Bandstand.
What I saw first was that they were fighting for civil rights. And I found further that they were fighting for nuclear disarmament and labor rights. I didn't know they were communists. I just felt like they were just good people fighting for a good cause.
Thing is, back then, being a member of the Communist Party was illegal. But for Tyner, who grew up poor in a segregated neighborhood of West Philadelphia, the idea of a future without poverty or racism or even property held a powerful appeal.
So when they finally said, you should join the Communist Party, I said yes. But I thought I'd be in for a couple of months and and learn a lot of stuff and then go on with my life.
But Tyner stayed. And the fact that most people here associated communism with dictators like Stalin or Pol Pot didn't faze him.
And I want to say that being here in the Soviet Union, land of Lenin, and celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Great October Revolution, this is just a wonderful spirit of optimism.
That's Tyner on Soviet state television in 1987, live in Red Square.
We didn't know the things that they were saying about Stalin were actually true. We thought it was propaganda primarily. We have communist leaders who have made terrible mistakes.
The collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 stripped the American Communist Party of its biggest patron and almost destroyed it, but in some ways turned out to be a blessing in disguise. Americans had always assumed the Communist Party USA was just a nefarious arm of the Soviet Party.
So what are we doing now that the Soviet Union exists and we're still fighting for socialism?
And what they're doing now is pretty similar to what they were doing in the 60s.
We can't breathe! We can't breathe! We can't breathe!
Black Lives Matter, the fight for a $15 minimum wage, the struggle against gentrification are all movements the party is focused on today. And, of course, the campaign of Bernie Sanders.
Bernie's doing a great job. 15,000 people coming to hear him speak. You know, this known socialist.
Today, the party has arrived at a different place, too, which has led to a debate about whether they should even hang on to the word communist.
I think it would be defensive to change the name, but other comrades feel differently. But I think we would spend the rest of our time saying, oh, we are the happy time party, but we used to be the communist party. You know, because people say, well, where'd you come from?
Answering that question will mostly fall to a new generation of communists or happy timers or Bernie Sanderites. In March, Tyner celebrated his retirement from the party staff at the Dallas Barbecue Restaurant.
You know, I'm 74. I got to make room for young people to come out.
He plans to spend time with his grandkids, take in some Broadway shows, travel. Not that he's giving up the struggle, you know, moving society toward a theoretical future where there's no such thing as money and all assets are shared. But in the meantime, no one ever said communists can't have fun.
Happy liberation.
Thank you.
For the world, this is Alina Simone from New York.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Three young Somali Americans on trial in Minnesota accused of supporting ISIS. The mother of one of them is adamant her son is not a terrorist, and neither is she.
We are not terrorists. Never been and never will be. This, we love this country more than you guys.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The three kids from Minneapolis used to go to the mall. They'd shoot hoops at the neighborhood courts. They're all in their early 20s, and they look pretty unremarkable, but they're not. The three young Somali Americans are standing trial on charges that include conspiracy to provide support to a terrorist group and to commit murder abroad. This is Minnesota's first ever ISIS trial, and jury selection is underway. Dua Ali Sai-Kautau of Minnesota Public Radio is at the courthouse in Minneapolis, and I asked her what it felt like in court.
It's very tense. First, they're still trying to figure out the jury pool. You have high security here, even inside the courtroom. You can see visibly that people are uncomfortable. And part of that is also that they have people who are in the courtroom looking straight at the family members who are sitting behind us, you know, concerned about potential threats in the courtroom and, of course, outside. So there's a lot of scrutiny. Even one of the mothers of the defendants was telling us that she had had trouble even trying to re-enter the courtroom. So it's a very uncomfortable time right now, not only just for the mothers, but for the community.
Right. Now, you've spoken with some of those mothers, and one of them last night, in fact, named Fadumo Hussein. She's the mother of 20-year-old Guled Omar, and she's translated here. Let's hear what she had to say.
All the allegations that are against my son, we are not terrorists. Never been and never will be. We will never be a terrorist. This, we love this country more than you guys. We live here, we left it a civil war. We know what it means.
We left a civil war, so we know really what that means, she said. Do you think there is a part of their mother's thinking that is still in Somalia while these kids are kind of living this other life? Is there a disconnect, I guess, is what I'm asking.
There's certainly a generational difference, right? Parents who have come here, who have left civil wars, such as the Somali community, they're trying to provide a better life for their children. They're looking to America as, you know, the new home for their children. And then you have these young kids who, some of them don't have fathers, and they're thinking about, you know, their parents' birthland or what's happening to their relatives back in Somalia or other places. And there's a concern about, well, what about the people we left behind? This is a very complex case.
And to make things even more complex, it turns out that members of the Somali American community in Minneapolis actually helped apprehend these young men, including another young Somali American named Abdurrahman Bashir. He used a hidden microphone to secretly record conversations with his friends. Can you tell us about him?
Well, that's right. And that's, I think, what the Somali American community is concerned about. Who was the brains behind this? And there, of course, is one of the witnesses that the government plans to call is this paid informant, Abdurrahman Bashir, who was a friend to these men. And so the question is, how much of a role did this paid informant have in sort of influencing these young men? Were they already sort of radicalized before or after this man came along? So there's a lot of concern about this person's role. And that's what's going to be presented in court, you know, in the next few weeks. What the government says about this man is going to be very critical to what the defense will say about their clients.
So what are the kind of sentences these young men potentially face?
We're talking about life in prison, and that's why the Somali American community and leaders here are saying, how can this be possible for young men who were essentially arrested when they were 18, 19, to be put in prison for life for not even having traveled to Syria? And essentially, at this point, it's words, not actions, and that's what the community members here are concerned about.
Duali Saikato of Minnesota Public Radio speaking from the Minneapolis courthouse where three young men stand accused of trying to join the terrorist group ISIS. Duali, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
France, in many ways, is a country of immigrants, but it has an uneasy relationship with newcomers, even people from its former colonies. It's only gotten more tense with the migrant crisis and the Paris terrorist attacks, and it's all forcing tough questions about what it means to be French today. In Paris, there's a museum of immigration that tackles some of those questions head-on, and Adeline Sear went to check it out.
The Art Deco Palace that houses the museum stands like a tall and ornate temple on a wide boulevard. This 1931 building was originally intended to honor France's colonial empire. Decades later, it seemed like the perfect spot for an immigration museum. In the permanent collection, you'll find contemporary art by and about immigrants. There's a piece called Climbing Down, for example. It's a bunk bed tower with cheap travel bags hanging from its sides. In the temporary gallery, there's a timely exhibition, Frontiers, about the role of borders in the history of migrations.
Ce musée, sa première mission, c'est de s'adresser aux Français et de leur faire connaître une part de leur propre histoire.
Historian Benjamin Stora heads the institution. He was born in Algeria when it was under French rule. He says France's immigration history goes back about 150 years, but is mostly ignored. So the role of this museum, unique in Europe, is to validate that history and to make up for a lack of education in French schools.
L'histoire de la France classique, l'histoire de la République, l'histoire de ses principes, la monarchie jusqu'à la République.
The history of classic France, from the monarchy to the Republic, is a history that needs to be taught and passed on. At the same time, you should make an effort to know the history of others who have come mostly from overseas, but are also part of French history. So, you need to teach different types of history and integrate them into the national conversation.
Teaching this history in schools is an idea that really matters to 30-year-old journalist Widad Ketfi. She works for the Bondi blog, which covers underreported stories in Parisian suburbs with large minority populations. Like the museum, the Bondi blog delves deeply into questions of identity. Ketfi says in today's France, you can't go on just teaching the history of the French kings, the Louis.
L'histoire des Louis, même si elle est intéressante et importante pour la culture générale.
The history of the Louis, even if it's interesting and important, she says, realistically, its impact on people's daily lives, on society and acceptance of the other, is much less important than the recent history of France, of colonization and decolonization, etc. Because contemporary French history would allow people to understand why the French are not only white, they are black and of many colors. That's part of the history of France.
Ça fait partie de l'histoire de France.
Today, about a quarter of the population has immigrant roots. Widad Ketfi, who's French of Algerian descent, says the lack of validation of immigrant history causes confusion about identity.
Souvent, on va entendre les jeunes qui parlent de français pour dire blanc.
You'll often hear minority youth say the French when they mean whites, she says. They exclude themselves because they're being excluded. Because today we have a hard time saying white, black, Arab, Asian, Chinese, even though it's not a bad word to say that someone is white or Arab. I'm French Arab. I have no problem with that. I think that if we talk about this honestly, we don't have to equate whiteness with French. Getting those words right really matters, she says.
C'est hyper important.
Widad Ketfi believes the issue of identity and integration will not evolve if there are no positive images of minorities to turn to in the media and elsewhere. She says this gap stands in huge contrast with what you see on American television.
Dans les séries américaines, le chef de service là dans Grey's Anatomy et le chef de service
in American TV series Grey's Anatomy, for example, the head of surgery being black, that's normal. He's not black. He's the head of the department. In France, he would be black first and foremost. This is a real problem here, both with the image that exists and the one with display, she says. There are a few exceptions, of course. In fact, two of the French government ministers very much in the news right now are Moroccan-born women. But the Immigration Museum's Benjamin Stora agrees there are far too few role models around, and he thinks it's had a devastating effect, especially for the millions of French Muslims here. He even worries it may encourage radicalism.
Ils ont le sentiment d'être éternellement vécus comme des étrangers, alors qu'ils sont français.
They feel like eternal foreigners, even though they are French. They say, we want to be French like you. We want to have politicians, TV anchors, newspaper editors. Eventually, some say, since you don't recognize us as French, we'll do something else. We'll go to Syria. All these youths born and educated in France, they are not perceived as French. And they ask, what do we have to do? Dye our hair blonde? That's the issue for me. How do we make space for them?
Making space for the excluded is what motivates Stora's work at the Museum of the History of Immigration. Almost a decade into its existence, the institution is coming of age at a time when the question of who gets to be French feels more relevant than ever. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
This next story is about peanuts, dry roasted peanuts. The U.S. government is planning to ship 500 metric tons of them to Haiti to feed malnourished children there. It sounds like a good idea, but it has caused an uproar, and journalist Amy Bracken is here to help us understand why. First of all, Amy, why send peanuts to Haiti?
So the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a program, the Stocks for Food program, in which they acquire surplus foods from farmers in the United States and donate them to people in need overseas.
So why would anybody be against that?
Well, you have to understand Haitian agriculture. It's taken a real beating in the last few decades, especially in the 80s and 90s, when there were trade liberalization measures that went into place, particularly with rice. The import tariff was reduced so much that Haiti went from being a country that was self-sufficient in rice to almost having the rice market destroyed by cheap U.S. imports. Much more recently, and a lot of people have been talking about this lately, Bill Clinton actually apologized for the role that he played in flooding the Haitian market with U.S. rice.
So who are the critics now when it comes to peanuts and dumping of peanuts in Haiti, and how upset are they?
Haitian farmers are upset, and a lot of NGOs, a lot of organizations that work in Haiti, Oxfam, Partners in Health, dozens of organizations, they've been sending around letters trying to get people to pressure the U.S. government to stop this. There was a petition with the White House that got thousands of signatures.
So critics think that, like rice, the same thing's going to happen to peanuts, that these 500 metric tons are just the tip of the iceberg. Is that a valid comparison?
Well, it seems like an exaggeration at first. I mean, you're talking about, as I said, hundreds of thousands of metric tons of rice that we're actually pouring into the Haitian market. Mm. In this case, the USDA says it's not only is it only 500 metric tons, but it's also very targeted. So it's not supposed to be sold. It's supposed to just go into schools. It's for starving kids. The concern is really that it's not going to happen that way, that it'll leak out. And some people think that this is the beginning of the end, that with rice, it started as donations. And then you would see bags of rice on the street saying for donation, for sale.
Mm. So you've done the taste test. What are Haitian peanuts like compared to American peanuts?
I've done much more than a taste test. Every time I'm in Haiti, like half of my diet is peanuts. I go everywhere with peanuts. They are delicious. They're crispy. They're fresh.
So to this main question, Amy, who's right here? The people saying don't flood the Haitian market with American peanuts, or the people saying, hey, we need some nutritional help on the ground here in Haiti?
Well, I think the U.S. Department of Agriculture makes a good point. I spoke with Alexis Taylor, the Deputy Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services. And I asked her to respond to all of these critics, and here's what she said.
I encourage them to go to Haiti and speak to the families that I spoke to and see the children who are getting the food. You know, many of these kids walk to school an hour without having breakfast, and the school lunch is the first meal of the day. It is about supporting a very vulnerable population. That's the crux of it. It is not about getting rid of really a small portion of peanuts that the U.S. government was holding. It was about an emergency need.
Yeah, so, I mean, nobody is questioning the fact that there's a severe problem of malnutrition in Haiti. But, of course, I mean, to respond to Oxfam and Partners in Health by saying, you need to go to Haiti and see this malnutrition problem, they obviously already know about this and are working on it. You know, they're arguing that we need to just step up the efforts that are already going on to try to get Haitian peanut farmers in a position where they can be supplying it the next time when there is this emergency need.
So what does this whole dust-up over peanuts tell you, Amy?
Well, it really underscores the fragility of agriculture in Haiti in general. I mean, very, very small scale, very little equipment, right next to this huge country that can make many of the same crops much more cheaply. So there's been a concern about this for a long time. But what some people are saying now is that this response to the peanut issue, it's big, it's impressive, and maybe it suggests that there is a growing movement for more national production or more focus on national production.
Amy Bracken, who's been reporting on Haiti for much of the last decade. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, an art forger gone legit who still loves the work. It's on the world. I know it's finally spring for real here in Boston because suddenly the squirrel population in my neighborhood seems to outnumber all the people on my block by a factor of 10. But squirrels in the UK are having a pretty hard time of it at the moment. That is, red squirrels. Their numbers have been declining for years. And now, to make matters worse, they're facing a devastating disease, leprosy. Anna Meredith of the University of Edinburgh has been researching these red squirrels. I asked her if leprosy in squirrels is the same disease that's plagued humans for millennia.
The symptoms are very similar indeed, and actually the pathology of the disease is almost identical to leprosy in people, which makes it really interesting from both an animal point of view, but also from a human point of view. So essentially these squirrels have very characteristic lesions. Their ears swell up, their nose swells up, and they lose the hair in these areas and also on their feet. And eventually they get ulcers and sores and are really quite badly affected. And what the disease also does is it makes the skin feel numb, and that's what it does in people as well. And that's why leprosy traditionally is thought of causing bits of you to drop off, you know, fingers and toes. Actually, that's because you can't feel those areas anymore, so they're more prone to damage.
So does that mean that this disease was spread from humans? And if so, is there any danger it'll spread back to humans?
Well, this is a really important question and key to our research and what we want to understand. Because it's essentially the same bacteria, we want to know which way it's gone, essentially. Is this something that's been in humans for, well, we know it's been in humans for thousands of years and is now in the red squirrel population, or is it the other way around, or is it just circulating between them? We simply don't know. It really is very unusual to find this form of leprosy in an animal.
So you're launching a new project, I gather, an experiment taking place on one small island off the south coast of England. Tell us about that project. Why on an island? And will this answer any of those questions about the disease jumping between humans and squirrels?
Well, we're using an island because it creates a really nice environment to run a study, because it's contained. We know there's a good population of about 200 red squirrels on this island. But it's also very important because it's about the only place in England where red squirrels are left. The population elsewhere has been devastated by the, unfortunately introduced from North America, the grey squirrel, which has wiped out our native red squirrels. But they're holding their own on this island, but unfortunately they've got this disease. So it creates a nice environment where we haven't got any grey squirrels and we can study the red squirrels in great detail.
We take squirrels for granted, I kind of feel. What does the UK lose if it doesn't have any red squirrels anymore?
Well, I think a lot, really. They're an iconic species and much loved by the British public. And I think, you know, as with any, the conservation of any species, it's a real shame to lose a species and essentially lose it through the actions of people. So we introduced the grey squirrels. We've cut down a lot of the trees and destroyed the habitat where the native red squirrel lives. And I think, to some extent, we do have a sort of moral obligation to try and limit some of that damage and reverse the change to save this very iconic species.
How red is the red squirrel? What's the reddest you've ever seen?
Oh, well, the really red ones can be really bright red. Well, it's a sort of browny, foxy sort of red. Mm. But actually, the species can vary in colour. Some of them are actually quite dark or even black. So it's a wide colour range.
Anna Meredith at the University of Edinburgh, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
David Henty definitely knows his reds from his grays, and that's because he is a painter of masterpieces. Problem is, they weren't exactly his masterpieces. He was copying Picassos and Modiglianis and Van Goghs and selling them on eBay. Henty was doing pretty well for a while, then he got caught and exposed by the Telegraph newspaper.
So that was that, really. I was outed. But up to that time, I was doing pretty well.
You had done forgeries of some pretty incredible artists, and nobody was the wiser, Van Gogh, Modigliani. But I gather people who saw the news about you started contacting you. What was that about?
Yeah, well, I started getting mail through the door to do artwork. Yeah, I started put together a body of work for my exhibition.
But, and this exhibition that's coming up, this is work that are basically forgeries, or now we know are copies, correct?
They're copies. They're very, very close copies. I mean, they're as near to perfect as you can get. Before, I was working with the curtains drawn, you know.
Right.
So to speak. And now it's out in the open. And yeah, it's great. I mean, I love doing, you know, Picasso's, Modigliani. You know, I've got the Van Goghs.
Mr. Henty, you did serve prison time for forgery, but not for paintings. It was for passports. And then there was a second charge in Spain that you served time for selling stolen cars. But
yeah.
Why no time for the crime of forging painting?
Oh, because I always put a caveat in my adverts. I had advice from, well, Scotland Yard, actually, the Art and Antique Squads. They contacted me one day. I said, well, if it's a problem, I'll take it off. And she said, no, it's not a problem because you've listed it correctly. You've listed it as sold strictly as after the artist. Yeah, I knew exactly how to get around it.
Yeah, clearly there's something about painting that really captivates you, because apparently you were caught in the passport scheme because you misspelt the words Britannic and Majesty. Not the same attention to detail with the paintings, apparently.
Well, actually, that was the printer, did it?
Oh, you're going to blame it on them now, huh?
Yeah, it wasn't me. Because I'm very good at signing paintings, you know, the signatures. But I have misspelt a couple before.
Have you ever done any original work? I mean, do you have any original David Henty's?
I have, yeah. My mum has got a collection of original David Henty's. But to be truthful, I like looking at a painting and working out how they did it. If I'm doing a Modigliani, I'll probably do five Modiglianis, you know, in a row, because I'll get into his footsteps, basically. And then work out all these little nuances and little tricks that he does, you know.
How far have you gone in the name of authenticity? Like, I don't know if you've seen the movie How to Steal a Million, but they go as far as, you know, getting dirt from Van Gogh's yard.
It took me weeks. Yeah, nice touch of authenticity, don't you think? I doubt very much if Van Gogh himself would have gone to such pains with his work.
He didn't have to. He was Van Gogh.
Have you gone that far?
They're quite secret, but, you know, I have my own techniques how to age a painting. Obviously, I can get good cracks in my paintings. I can get patina.
So what was the highest sum you ever received for one of your forgeries? And did the person buying know it was a forgery, or they know it was a really good copy?
Well, I mean, I've only received threes and fours and five thousands. But in the past, when I was doing eBay, I used to sell paintings and they used to make £500, £700.
So, Mr. Henty, at the end of the day, does it feel better to be legit and copying, or would you rather be a forger still?
I love being a forger. I love it. You know, I love art, and I feel privileged to be a, you know, copy the masters, you know. Yeah, I love it.
David Henty, thanks for speaking with us. Really great to meet you.
And you.
Papa has seen the light. He's going straight.
Papa, will you be all right?
He'll survive.
Think you can tell the difference between Henty's forgeries and the real thing? Take the test. We've got some of his work up along with the originals for your comparing pleasure over at PRI.org. That is The World on this Tuesday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.